You're listening to LawPod UK from the creators of the UK Human Rights Blog. It's a podcast that discusses developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. LawPod UK is produced by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row and is presented by Rosalind English.
Last week, the Supreme Court ruled that an elderly pedestrian who was knocked over by a suspect and police officers who were running after him could sue the police for damages for her injuries. In Robinson and West Yorkshire Police, the judges found that the officers had acted negligently, as they could have chosen somewhere safer than the High Street to try to arrest the suspected drug dealer. The judgment has been widely cast as opening up the floodgates to legal actions against the police. But it's also an excellent primer on tort law as it's evolved in our modern welfare society and where we all now stand. Isabel McArdle has reported on the case for the UK Human Rights Blog, and she's here to cast light on this judgment for us. Isabel, let's begin at the beginning. This was a fairly straightforward set of facts, wasn't it?
Yes, it absolutely is. It involved an elderly woman, a 76-year-old, who was just going about her business in the centre of Huddersfield. And unbeknownst to her, the police were planning to try to arrest a suspect. And the police had predicted this suspect might try to either resist arrest or run. So they had sort of come up with a strategy to try to get him in a public place. And unfortunately for the claimant, they attempted their arrest just as she was passing by. And the result was the suspect inevitably resisted arrest. The three men ended up falling into the claimant, and she suffered quite nasty injuries as a result. And so she, perhaps understandably, wanted some redress for that and brought a claim in negligence.
But this simple sequence of events has engendered legal arguments that have gone all the way up to the Supreme Court. Could you take us through the passage of this case through the courts, Isabel?
So it absolutely is one which is has gone all the way through the court, despite its perhaps simple-sounding facts to the average member of the public. So at trial, the judge thought that there had been negligence on the part of the police, for example, in the way that they went about conducting the arrest. One of the police officers, for instance, admitted that he hadn't actually seen the claimant before he attempted to arrest the suspect. However, importantly, and this is where the law really gets interesting, the judge found that there was immunity from suit, meaning that there couldn't be a negligence claim brought because there shouldn't be a duty of care in these circumstances. And the judge applied the very well-known Caparo test and found in particular on that third limb of the test that it wouldn't be fair, just and reasonable for there to be a duty of care in these circumstances. So the case went on to the Court of Appeal, and the Court of Appeal gave a judgment finding that in most claims for negligence against the police, you're going to find that they fail on that third stage, is it fair, just and reasonable for there to be a duty of care? So there isn't going to be a duty of care against the police in most of those cases. Public interest is really the thing that's found to weigh against there being a duty of care, because the police, of course, are expected to be going about not thinking about how they can avoid negligence claims, but allocating their resources as they see fit to fight crime and investigate crime as best as they can. Now, in terms of the test to be applied whenever considering whether there is a duty of care in a negligence case, the Court of Appeal said, well, we should always be applying the Caparo test. And in this case, where the police are really engaging in their core functions, i.e. what they're very much expected by the public to be doing, going about arresting suspects, it wouldn't be fair, just and reasonable to impose a duty to protect members of the public from physical harm. They also found that there wasn't satisfaction of the second Caparo test, that is, whether there's proximity between the person who suffers injury and the person who is alleged to have committed the tort. And they also found that the findings of negligence by the judge were themselves wrong. So that was the position when the case came before the Supreme Court.
So what extent did this case involve a new question, or in the jargon, a novel duty of care?
Well, I think a lot of commentators think that it did. It's certainly perhaps surprising to say that it didn't, given that it's gone all the way through the courts to the Supreme Court, if it was such a simple issue. But it's fair to say that the majority in the Supreme Court thought It didn't involve a new question. They essentially found that where there is creation of a risk of injury, and that risk is foreseeable, well, it doesn't matter if you're the police or if you're Joe Bloggs, that's an established situation where a duty arises. Now, the minority did disagree. They thought it was really a new example, but where there should nevertheless be a duty of care. I think it's quite interesting just to contrast it with some of the history of cases that have happened quite recently to really highlight how unpredictable it has sometimes been as to whether or not there will be a duty of care owed by the police and how, generally speaking, it's difficult to establish. There's the Michael case, Supreme Court case from 2015. That was a case where a deceased person had called the police and reported that her ex-partner had attacked her and was going to return immediately and had said he would kill her. And sadly, she was killed when her ex-partner returned. But the police didn't respond urgently, and so there was an attempt to bring a negligence claim on those facts. And even on those facts, there was no duty of care. The immunity from suit applied because there was no what we call assumption of responsibility. There wasn't some special relationship in which the police had sort of taken on a responsibility to look after the particular person who called them. The call handler hadn't sort of promised to send urgent help or something of that nature. So obviously where we have recent history of cases where even on those facts it's very difficult to found a duty of care, it's I suppose perhaps unsurprising that legal commentators expected that this would be a case where there might not be a duty of care. Of interest in the Michael case, Lord Toulson said about the Caparo test, the test that I think we've all been assuming until relatively recently is the key test to apply whenever you want to decide if there's a duty of care or not in negligence. But Lord Toulson reminded us, I suppose, that the point of the Caparo case was not to say this is a universal test that applies always, but it's just a useful tool. It's not a blueprint or a single general principle that we can apply in all cases.
And I suppose the critical factor was distinguishing this case from Michael and Hills was that in those cases, the defendant, the police, played no active part in the critical events. This seems to be a very important point.
So this is really the crucial difference that the Supreme Court outlined as meaning that in this circumstance, there is a duty of care. Whereas even where you have facts like in Michael, you don't have a duty of care. There have been similar cases to Michael, joint cases called Van Coll and Smith, again, where police had received information about threats to the physical safety of particular individuals. But again, just like in Michael, the danger is being posed by some third party rather than by the police themselves, and there wasn't a duty of care. What made the difference, as you say, in this case, Robinson, is that the police themselves caused the danger by taking action at that particular public place where they could foresee that the suspect might well run or struggle and that members of the public in the vicinity could be injured as a consequence of that.
At the core of this question is the debate about duty to rescue, isn't it? So in this country and other states with similar common law systems, you won't get into trouble with the law if you walk past an emergency situation without intervening. Our law of negligence only catches harm to other people. We are not required to provide them with benefits. But this is complicated by state bodies, like the police, having certain powers and duties, isn't it?
Yes, so I think that that's actually a very convenient summary. Of course, as you say, the average person on the street is not expected to rescue. You can't sue them if they don't. But what complicates the picture with public bodies is that public bodies have a whole range of duties, as a matter of public law, to protect members of the public from harm, and they have powers and discretions, which allow them to act, to intervene in certain situations to try to prevent harm. So, for example, public authorities may have powers to make roads safer. They have powers to remove children from abusive homes and so forth. So they are in a situation in which it's extremely foreseeable that if they don't do certain things, and sometimes if they do certain things, that they can either fail to prevent harm or can cause harm by not exercising their statutory powers to prevent the sort of harm which the central government has said it is their duty, as a matter of public law, to go about trying to prevent, you know, coming to be. So this has really, I think, created quite a lot of difficulty for the courts. They've grappled over the last few decades with these issues, in particular trying to balance the need to protect the public, but with the finite resources that public authorities have and the fact that public authorities have public law duties to the public at large. And so the idea of them stepping in to protect one particular member of the public and being liable as a matter of private law if they don't has not typically found favour with the court, although there have been inroads made into it.
Okay, so we probably need to back up a bit on the Caparo test for imposing a duty of care, and indeed the history of what it replaced, Anne's and Merton Borough Council and so on.
So Anne's was a 1978 House of Lords case, a trial on preliminary issues. The background was that a local authority had approved some building plans for some flats, but it didn't inspect the building works as they were being done, and it had a power to do that before granting the approval, but it hadn't exercised it. In any event, they were built, and lo and behold, the flats turned out to be defective, so the lessees wanted to pursue the local authority in negligence for the way they'd gone about approving the building plans. And what's really crucial about the case is that Lord Wilberforce tried to lay down a universal test in negligence for where you find that there is a duty of care. There were two stages to it. The first was that prima facie, there is a duty of care if harm is foreseeable. That's a very broad principle. But the second principle was that there should be limits placed on that duty where public policy reasons demanded it. Now, as you can imagine, that test did create huge implications for public authorities because, as we just discussed, their duties are very commonly to try to prevent harm to the public. That is the nature of a lot of their statutory duties or their public law duties. So it really led to a period where duty of care cases were, well, at best unpredictable, and I think a lot of commentators would say really the scope of the duty of care after Anne's was too wide. So Caparo then was a 1990 case of the House of Lords about 12 years later. This was a case where potential purchasers wanted to sue some accountants. Those accountants had prepared a report into a company's profitability, and as it happened, they'd overstated how valuable the shares were going to be. And so the potential purchasers had purchased some shares and become actual purchasers, and then had lost money, and they wanted to bring a claim in negligence against the accountants. And the House of Lords, in this case, produced a different test, which has produced rather narrower results for where there's a duty of care, and that's the very well-versed three-stage test. You have to have foreseeability of harm, proximity, and then the third stage is it fair, just and reasonable to impose a duty of care? So that has really been the test, I suppose, ever since 1990, or at least it's been very widely cited and relied upon and used to explore issues in cases where we have potentially novel duty of care situations. I think just to bring it back to Robinson, what's really interesting in the Robinson case is that the Supreme Court felt, the majority anyway, felt that this wasn't really a Caparo case. They didn't need to get into the Caparo three-stage test because on the ordinary application of the principles of negligence, there was a duty of care here, a duty of care to protect an individual from a danger of injury which the police themselves had created. And so the Supreme Court was saying that is already one of our established categories, just as, for example, a road traffic accident is one of the established categories. So we don't need to get into this question of policy factors which come into the third stage Caparo fair, just and reasonableness test. And the minority very much disagreed. I suspect that they are probably largely agreed with by the legal commentators, because they said, this is either a new category or at least we're expanding a category. And so we do need to apply CAPARO. But on applying that third stage CAPARO test, the minority found that there should be a new category where the police take positive action, deliberate action, in circumstances where it's foreseeable that the public might suffer personal injury, that in those circumstances there should be a duty of care. So what's interesting about the Robinson case is not perhaps so much where everybody ends up, everybody allows the appeal, but the reasoning by which the majority versus the minority got there.
And, of course, this is going to create problems, or it's obviously going to have implications for other emergency services and even those tasked with child protection because of the duties that are imposed on them.
Yes, absolutely. It's certainly the case that it's likely to be argued as a basis to widen the scope of duties of care, perhaps in some areas where we've seen the courts really shut down that sort of argument before. I can certainly see that. I think that it's an interesting decision, because I think we'd all assumed beforehand that CAPARO really was the orthodoxy, and that wherever we have a case where there is at least a question mark about the duty of care, then we bring out the CAPARO test, apply it, and we get to the right answer, at least we hope we do. But this is a case where I think a lot of people had predicted that this was a novel area for a duty of care and a difficult area for a duty of care. And yet here we have the Supreme Court saying, no, this is just a straightforward personal injury, positive act, not an omission, and therefore there's a duty of care.
I think we've pretty much covered the content of the case, the history, and its possible future implications. We'll see what comes out of the Supreme Court next time they consider something similar. Isabel, thank you so much for that very interesting and helpful explanation.
You're very welcome.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and recommend us to a friend.